fundamentally pigmentocratic, characterized by a social spectrum with taller, lighter-skinned European-blooded elites at one end, shorter, darker, indigenous-blooded masses at the other end, and a great deal of passing in between. The roots of pigmentocracy are traceable to the colonial era. Unlike their British counterparts in, say, India or Malaysia, the Spanish colonialists freely and prolifically procreated with indigenous women. From the outset, Spanish and Portuguese chroniclers waxed enthusiastic about the charms of Amerindian women, who were beautiful and not a little lascivious and fond of the Spaniards, by one account, and very handsome and great lovers, affectionate and with ardent bodies, by another. In an important sense, the Spanish conquest of the Americas was a conquest of women. The Spaniards obtained the Indian girls both by force and by peaceful means, sometimes as tokens of friendship from Indian leaders. Intermarriage, concubinage, and polygamy were common. Although this racial mixing might suggest a readiness among Latin America's colonizers to transcend ethnic boundaries and skin color, in reality, it was nothing of the sort. On the contrary, what emerged was an invidious social system known as the Society of Castes, Sociedad de Castas, in which individuals were classified in accordance with their racial purity, with whites occupying the highest stratum. The names of the specific castas that emerged in Spanish America varied across different regions and changed over the years. The following list is illustrative of 18th century New Spain. 1. Spaniard and Indian beget mestizo. 2. Mestizo and Spanish women beget castizo. 3. Castizo woman and Spaniard beget Spaniard. 4. Spanish woman and negro beget mulatto. 5. Spaniard and mulatto woman beget morisco. 6. Morisco woman and Spaniard beget albino. 7. Spaniard and albino woman beget torna atrás. 8. Indian and torna atrás beget lobo. 9. Lobo and Indian woman beget zambigo. 10. Zambigo and Indian woman beget cambujo. 11. Cambujo and mulatto woman beget albarazado. 12. Albarazado and mulatto woman beget barcino. 13. Barcino and mulatto woman beget coyote. 14. Coyote woman and Indian beget chamizo. 15. Chamizo woman and mestizo beget coyote mestizo. 16. Coyote mestizo and mulatto woman beget ahi te estas. That the Spaniards were supposed to be pure-blooded is, to say the least, ironic. Among the numerous groups that, by the Middle Ages, had inhabited and co-mingled with one another on Iberian soil were Celts, Greeks, Phoenicians, Carthaginians, Romans, Visigoths, Jews, Arabs, Berbers, and Gypsies. Nevertheless, with the exception of countries like Chile and Uruguay, where indigenous people were largely extinguished almost immediately, disdain among a pure white Spanish elite for the colored masses is a deeply ingrained feature of the history of every modern Latin American country. In Mexico, mixed-blooded mestizos were for years prohibited from owning land or joining the clergy. In Peru, even intellectuals believed that The Indian is not now, nor can he ever be, anything but a machine. In Chile, victory in the War of the Pacific, 1879-83, was often attributed to the whiteness of the Chileans, as compared with the defeated Indians of Bolivia and Peru. In Argentina, a popular writer wrote in 1903 that mestizos and mulattoes were both impure, atavistically anti-Christian. They are like the two heads of a fabulous hydra that surrounds, constricts, and strangles with its giant spiral a beautiful, pale virgin, Spanish America. In Venezuela, there was an added layer of complexity and racism due to the importation of roughly 100,000 slaves from Africa between the 16th and 19th centuries. Indeed, according to one historian, more than half of Venezuela's population was black when the country declared independence in 1811. Over the centuries, Venezuela's elites blamed all of the country's social ills on the constant mixing of whites, Indians, and blacks, and repeatedly and actively encouraged immigration from Europe in order to whiten Venezuela. After World War II, substantial numbers of immigrants arrived from Spain, Portugal, Italy, Germany, and other countries. This post-war influx from Europe slowed the long-standing tendency in the country toward racial mixing. Nevertheless, throughout the 20th century, a national myth, promoted by the country's intellectuals and elites, perpetuated the idea that Venezuela was a racial democracy, in which racism and discrimination did not exist. As late as 1997, a prominent Venezuelan businessman and columnist wrote, "In Venezuela, we complain about a lot of things that we think are wrong, but we have some things that should serve as an example to other countries. One is that race is not important in judging a person. In Venezuela, racial discrimination is not a factor either in employment or in social or intellectual realms. Prejudice against someone because of the color of his skin does not exist. This is not an obstacle here, as it is in other places." As elsewhere in Latin America, this myth of colorblindness and everyone is a mestizo conveniently hid the fact that wealth was overwhelmingly concentrated in white hands, while the country's impoverished underclass, representing a full 80% of the population, consisted primarily of darker-skinned Venezuelans with more indigenous and African ancestry. At the same time, the myth suppressed the mobilization of the country's poor along ethnic or racial lines. Thus, on the eve of the 1998 presidential election, even as Venezuela's elite proudly declared that their country was free of racism, a small minority of cosmopolitan whites, including descendants of the original Spanish colonizers, as well as more recent European immigrants, dominated Venezuela economically, politically, and socially. This domination was at its most visible in the country's beauty pageants. Whiteness was equated with perfection. The blonde Saez, the Miss Venezuela who lost to Chavez, was described by the media as the most perfect woman in the history of all the beauty pageants of the universe. Conversely, any sign of African or Indian heritage, including broader noses, fuller mouths, or pelo malo, bad hair, the derogatory term for tightly curled black hair, was considered ugly. Hair straightening is another extremely profitable industry in Venezuela. Many black, indigenous, and darker-skinned Venezuelans internalized this Eurocentric standard of beauty. President Hugo Chavez. It probably never occurred to Venezuela's white elite that they actually might lose power. It probably never occurred to the U.S. foreign establishment either, since these elites were basically their only points of contact. After all, they controlled not only the country's oil sector, but the media, banks, foreign investment networks, all the most valuable land, and the most lucrative businesses. As elsewhere in Latin America, this minority was also very closely knit. As one Venezuelan put it, "In Venezuela, there are more boards of directors than there are directors." But in 1998, the Venezuelan people, exercising their democratic power, elected Hugo Chavez as president in a landslide victory, to the horror of the United States. Chavez reversed the vector of Venezuelan racism. Instead of being embarrassed by his mixed origins, Chavez defiantly called himself the Indian from Barinas and reveled in his indigenous and African features, once gloating to an interviewer, "Hate against me has a lot to do with racism." By combining ethnicity with populism and class appeals, Chavez galvanized Venezuela's destitute majority, most of whom, like Chavez, are mixed-blooded, with thick mouths and visibly darker skin than most of the nation's elite. "He is one of us," cried cheering washerwomen, maids, and peasants. "We've never had another president like that before." For all the talk of colorblind racial democracy, Venezuela's elite couldn't help themselves. They called Chavez El Negro, the black, and Ese Mono, that monkey. Political graffiti like "Death to the Monkey Chavez" began to appear on the walls of upper and middle class neighborhoods. In one political cartoon, he was depicted as an ape. But Chavez used all this to his advantage. He fashioned himself as the champion of Venezuela's oppressed. Once in office, he passed a new constitution guaranteeing for the first time cultural and economic rights for indigenous populations. His government also passed a law against racial discrimination, a remarkable step in a country where the mere existence of race, let alone racism, had long been denied. Commentators disagree slightly about whether Chavez created racial consciousness in Venezuela by repeatedly sending the message that the rich people are racist and they hate you, or whether he embraced an already existing movement demanding that race be taken seriously. Regardless, what differentiated Chavez from other politicians was, in the words of Moises Naim, a former Venezuelan minister of trade and industry and later editor of Foreign Policy, his enthusiastic willingness to tap into collective anger and social resentments that other politicians failed to see, refused to stoke, or, more likely, had a vested interest in not exacerbating. Deliberately fomenting class conflict and lacing it with ethnic and racial resentment, Chavez broke with the tradition of multi-class political parties and the illusion of social harmony that prevailed in Venezuela for four decades. Like all demagogues, Chavez was a master at tribal politics. "Oligarchs tremble," he campaigned to great agitated crowds, referring to Venezuela's rotten elites. He also attacked foreign investors, calling them squealing pigs and rich degenerates. Chavez swept to electoral victory not by offering a well-thought-out economic policy. Rather, in Naim's words, he "catered to the emotional needs of a deeply demoralized nation," employing an inchoate but very effective folksy mixture of Bolivarian soundbites, Christianity, collectivist utopianism, baseball, and indigenous cosmogony, peppered with diatribes against oligarchs, neoliberalism, foreign conspiracies, and globalization. Chavez was the first president not to invite the winner of the Miss Venezuela pageant to the presidential palace after her crowning. He also ordered that two oil tankers named after former white Miss Venezuelas, the Maritza Sayalero and the Pilin León, be named Negra Hipólita and Negra Matea, two legendary black women who, according to lore, raised Simón Bolívar. The Chavez regime also saw Venezuela crown its first non-white Miss Venezuela. Backlash by Venezuela's elite. Chavez's nationalization and anti-business policies upended the economy. Fearful of confiscation, Venezuela's wealthy elites withdrew more than $8 billion, transferring most of it to overseas banks. But the real battleground between Chavez and the Venezuelan elite was the national oil company, PDVSA, which generates about 95% of the country's export earnings and represents the nation's lifeblood. Although technically state-owned, PDVSA was famous for being efficiently run by members of the business elite, oligarchs, in Chavez's view. In March 2002, Chavez fired PDVSA's president, General Guaicaipuro Lameira, widely respected by foreign investors for his professional steering of the oil behemoth. In Lameira's place, Chavez installed a left-wing academic with little business experience. In April 2002, only a few weeks later, a coup deposed Chavez, who was taken by force to a military base. Astonishingly, the Bush administration hailed the coup as a victory for democracy. If, as is rumored, the United States was behind the coup, the move was a massive moral and strategic mistake. If instead, as the Bush administration insisted, it had no connection to the coup and genuinely believed that Chavez's ouster was a democratic triumph, this was an astounding display of blindness to the realities of Venezuela's tribal politics. The coup was a classic effort led by a market-dominant minority to retaliate against a democratically elected government threatening their wealth and power. Although supported at first by trade union leaders and skilled labor, the regime that briefly uprooted Chavez looked like it had come from the country club. Interim President Pedro Carmona, a wealthy white, was head of the country's largest business association. Union representatives were completely excluded from positions of authority. "All of them oligarchs," scoffed a dark-skinned street vendor. "Couldn't they have appointed one person like us?" To the dismay of the Bush administration, and the embarrassment of major U.S. newspapers like the New York Times and the Chicago Tribune, which initially supported Chavez's resignation, a popular uprising returned Chavez to power with stunning speed. Not thousands, but millions of Chavez supporters, mostly poor from the barrios, surrounded the presidential palace, and within 48 hours, Chavez was back in office. Except for the United States, every democratic country in the Western Hemisphere, even those at odds with Chavez, had condemned the coup. By appearing to support the abortive overthrow of a democratically elected leader and calling it a victory for democracy, the United States committed a serious misstep. We looked not only, as the BBC put it, rather stupid, but hypocritical, and our influence in the region declined sharply. But the battle was not over. It would be a fight to the death. In December 2002, strikes broke out, shutting down oil production and bringing the entire economy to a grinding halt. In the United States, strikes are usually instigated by blue-collar workers seeking higher wages. Venezuela's strikes, however, were spearheaded by the country's wealthy business elite, along with other anti-Chavez groups. I explained this in a January 2003 op-ed in the New York Times, while making the larger point that democracy in conditions of extreme inequality can create political and economic instability, leading to the election of populist, anti-free market leaders. In addition, I pointed out, there is also an ethnic dimension to Venezuela's crisis. Along with roughly 80% of Venezuela's population, Mr. Chavez is a pardo, a term with both class and ethnic overtones that refers loosely to brown-skinned people of Amerindian or African ancestry. But Venezuela's economy has always been controlled by a tiny minority of cosmopolitan whites. I was completely unprepared for what happened next. I began receiving a deluge of vicious hate emails at a rate of about 100 a minute, all from Venezuelans. A number of things stood out. First, they were all in English, suggesting that they were written by relatively privileged Venezuelans. Many of the writers were affiliated with businesses or universities and had U.S. connections. Second, they virtually all insisted that Chavez was an anti-democratic force, rarely mentioning that he had been democratically elected. Finally, they were adamant that anti-Chavez opposition had nothing to do with race because racism did not exist in Venezuela. Here are a few relatively moderate samples. As a Venezuelan, I was appalled at Dr. Amy Chua's superficial and biased treatment of the Venezuelan situation in her January 7th article, Power to the Privileged. Class hatred and racism have never been a real issue in Venezuela. Venezuela is a social and racial melting pot that has allowed children from humble backgrounds to move up in the world, get a good education, job, or political position. Also, this melting pot has produced some of the most beautiful women in the world who consistently earn Miss Universe and Miss World titles. Race has never been an issue in Venezuela. The fact that Chavez, whom you describe as a pardo, which he is not, by the way, may have a darker color of his skin, does not at all constitute, and has never constituted, a social prejudice in Venezuelan social behavior. So, Professor Chua, you don't have the slightest idea of what you are talking about. However, Chavez himself has openly spread the issue of the color of his skin in order to justify his dictatorial behavior, and you have fallen for it. Having grown up in Venezuela and lived there for 30 years, I can attest that racial lines are almost non-existent. Blacks and pardos have today the same opportunities and lifestyles as Caucasians. And literally hundreds more like this. The email campaign seemed to be well organized. As if following a protocol, most of them copied my dean, the president of Yale, and every member of my faculty, not to mention Hillary Clinton and the head of the United Nations. As it happened, I had just started teaching at Yale Law School, and many of my brand new colleagues came up to me with strange looks on their faces to ask what was going on. I also received death threats, including one that said, "Venezuelans will get you in Chicago," where I was scheduled to give a talk. The venue provided bodyguards. When I gave a talk at the University of Pennsylvania, Venezuelans protested the lecture. Today, the storyline has changed. Venezuela's glaring racial inequities are now widely acknowledged, as is the fact that Chavez's popularity was based in significant part on his ability to turn Indian and African heritage into a source of pride, identity, and mobilization against a long dominant white elite. Chavez was not the only Latin American leader to play the ethnic card. Similarly ethnically tinged populist movements swept Alejandro Toledo to victory in Peru and Evo Morales to the presidency in Bolivia. Chavez was re-elected in a landslide in 2006, then again in 2012. However else his legacy may be judged, Chavez undoubtedly delivered to his poor constituents. As of 2012, Chavez had cut poverty by half and extreme poverty by 70%. College enrollment doubled, and millions had access to health care for the first time. As Brazil's President Lula said that year, a victory for Chavez is a victory for the people of Venezuela. Although Chavez was the beneficiary of high oil prices for many years, it's often said that Venezuela's leaders' fortunes rise and fall with the price of oil, the fact remains that by many metrics, Venezuela was more democratic under Chavez than before he came to power. At the same time, there is also no doubt that Chavez was a strongman with autocratic leanings and that his achievements exacted an enormous economic cost. By 2006, government expenditures were exceeding government revenues. To stay afloat, Chavez borrowed more than $55 billion from China and Russia. As inflation soared, Chavez imposed price controls, which, according to many, disincentivized manufacturing and started the country on the road to today's disastrous shortages. Oil production, drained of expertise and foreign investment, fell sharply, crippled by operational failures. Nevertheless, Chavez maintained surprising popularity right up until his death, which was met with massive grief among Chavistas and Venezuela's underclass. Chavez had won the hearts of the poor. His embrace of a long-neglected, long-spurned swath of Venezuela endeared him to them, and they were willing to look past his shortcomings. One of the most extraordinary features of Chavez's presidency was his reality TV show, Alo Presidente, Hello President, which aired every Sunday at 11 a.m. and went on for as long as Chavez wanted, usually 4 to 8 hours. Utterly unprecedented and shocking at the time, Chavez's persona, part entertainer, part head of state, may seem strangely familiar to Americans today. The conceit was that the Venezuelan people should get to see the revolution unfolding. So, every week, Chavez would appear live, sometimes on the street, sometimes in front of an audience in the presidential palace, and talk, joke, sing, issue decrees, or order people to jail. Occasionally, he interviewed other heads of state, Oprah style. Because he made actual policy on the show, often without any warning, it was imperative for his cabinet members to watch in order to keep current. And when he would point to a building and declare, "Expropiese," expropriate it, the live audience would burst into applause. In 2010, Chavez joined Twitter and was immensely successful, using his account to post missives ranging from insults directed at other countries to what he had eaten for lunch. Just ate a tremendous bowl of fish soup. He once gave a 19-year-old woman an apartment for becoming his 3 millionth follower. Outrageous and unfiltered, he tweeted about everything from trips, "Hey, how's it going? I'm off to Brazil," to revolution, "We will be victorious," to his gastrointestinal problems, "Hello, Tums." Loathed by the elite, he was, until his death, a man of the people. Chavez died suddenly of colon cancer in 2013, a little more than a year after he suggested that the U.S. government might be secretly infecting Latin America's left-wing leaders with cancer cells. Chavez's vice president and successor, Nicolás Maduro, tried to continue Chavez's policies, but without Chavez's charisma or shrewdness. Venezuela's crisis turned into a full-blown collapse when global oil prices plummeted in 2014, plunging Venezuela into a state of mass hunger and rampant crime. In 2016, inflation hit 800%. Shortages of basic staples like milk, rice, meat, and toilet paper have triggered protests across the country, met by the government with deadly force. Today, Venezuela is practically a failed state. While Maduro claims the Chavista mantle, it does not appear that he has popular support, with even many die-hard Chavez supporters demanding that he step down, denouncing him for destroying Chavez's good name. His July 2017 creation of a new Constituent Assembly, filled with supporters, including his son and his wife, was widely viewed as an anti-democratic bid to consolidate autocratic power and stifle dissent. Moreover, according to Naim, Maduro is increasingly a puppet for Cuba, military strongmen, and drug traffickers, who wield the real power over the country's crumbling state. When democracy does battle against a market-dominant minority, as it did in Venezuela throughout the Chavez era, the consequences can ultimately be catastrophic. In the worst cases, both the economy and democracy can be ravaged. Sadly, this worst-case scenario appears to be playing out in Venezuela today. Chapter 7. Inequality and the Tribal Chasm in America. What a chimera, then, is man! What a novelty! What a monster! What a chaos! What a contradiction! What a prodigy! Judge of all things, feeble earthworm, repository of truth, sewer of uncertainty and error, the glory and the scum of the universe. Blaise Pascal. Professing to be wise, they became fools. Romans chapter 1, verse 22. The Middle East, Southeast Asia, and Latin America may seem worlds away from the United States, but America is not immune to the forces of tribal politics tearing those regions apart. We all have a vague sense that inequality lies at the heart of our country's deep divides, but exactly how is poorly understood. It turns out that in America, there's a chasm between the tribal identities of the country's haves and have-nots, a chasm of the same kind wreaking political havoc in many developing and non-Western countries. In America, as in Venezuela, great swaths of the country have come to regard the establishment, the political and economic elite, as foreign and even threatening to them. In America, as in Venezuela, a highly improbable candidate with no political experience swept to the presidency by attacking that establishment and leading what was widely called a revolution. The difference, of course, is that Hugo Chavez's revolution was socialist, and Donald Trump's decidedly was not. Populism in America is not anti-capitalist. America's have-nots don't hate wealth. Many of them want it, or want their children to have a shot at it, even if they think the system is rigged against them. Whether black, white, or Latino, poor and working-class Americans hunger for the old-fashioned American dream. Hence the endless popularity of shows like American Idol, The Voice, The Apprentice, Empire, The Sopranos, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, Shark Tank, and Duck Dynasty. When the American dream eludes them, even when it mocks them or spits in their faces, they would sooner turn on the establishment or on the law or on immigrants and other outsiders or even on reason than turn on the dream itself. In America, it's the progressive elites who have taken it upon themselves to expose the American dream as false. This is their form of tribalism. A jarring amount of upper-income progressive activism serves as a vehicle for elite group identity formation. But this form of progressive tribalism didn't work in 2016. As David Leonhardt put it in an essay called How Democrats Can Get Their Mojo Back, whites without college degrees shifted sharply to Donald Trump, and blacks without college degrees affected the result by staying home in larger numbers. Both decisions stemmed, in part, from alienation. Yes, inequality is fracturing our nation. But just as America's foreign policy establishment repeatedly fails to understand the group realities that matter most to people abroad, America's elites have been blind to, or dismissive of, the group identities that matter most to ordinary Americans. If we want to understand our current political turmoil, we need to open our eyes to the vastly different group identities of America's rich and poor. The Occupy Movement. A City University of New York, CUNY, study of the participants at a major Occupy rally on May 1, 2012, found that about one quarter were students. Of the non-students, 76% had a bachelor's degree, and of this group, more than half had postgraduate degrees. The participants were also disproportionately affluent. More than half had incomes of $75,000 or more. Only about 8% earned less than $25,000, compared to almost 30% of New Yorkers as a whole. In a different study of Occupy protesters in New York's Zuccotti Park, veteran Democratic Party pollster Douglas Schoen concluded, "Our research shows clearly that the movement doesn't represent unemployed America. The vast majority of demonstrators are actually employed." Yet another poll, which surveyed more than 5,000 visitors to the OccupyWallStreet.org website, found that 90.1% had more than a high school education and 81.2% were white. Only 1.6% were black. While other surveys show considerably more racial and ethnic diversity, there is consensus that occupiers were disproportionately young, white, and highly educated, which helps explain the movement's oft-noted technological savvy. Also striking, Occupy participants were unusually politically active, much more so than the American population as a whole. According to the CUNY study, 94% of those surveyed had previously participated in another political protest, and 42% said that they had previously participated in 30 or more such events during their lifetimes. Nearly 50% were also active in other organizations, including immigrant rights groups, women's rights groups, and anti-war organizations. As the CUNY study concluded, Occupy Wall Street was not a spontaneous movement that appeared out of nowhere. It was carefully planned by a group of experienced political activists. Other anti-inequality groups in America have similar attributes. Take, for example, the Other 98%, which describes itself as a non-profit organization and a grassroots network of concerned people that shines a light on economic injustice, undue corporate influence, and threats to democracy, We work to kick corporate lobbyists out of D.C., hold elected officials accountable, and make America work for the other 98% of us. The team of six talented leaders featured on their website includes a former Wall Street analyst, a former web designer for Bank of America, two graduates of Bard College, a highly selective liberal arts school, a veteran affinity group organizer, and a former Greenpeace worker who has had the great fortune to be integrally involved in powerful, peaceful actions all over the world, from the high seas with the Rainbow Warrior to the streets of Seattle, and who now works from his home office on a sleepy little island in the Puget Sound where he and his wife, Genevieve, homeschool their 8-year-old twins. Occupy Wall Street was, in the words of one of its creators, Micah White, a failure. White might have overstated it. The Occupy movement brought inequality to the forefront of public debate, and many attribute to Occupy the attention given in the 2016 presidential campaign to Wall Street greed, student debt, and increasing the minimum wage. But as journalist George Packer put it, Occupy Wall Street flashed across the sky and flared out, more a meme than a movement. The most common theories for why the Occupy movement failed include the absence of a strong, visible leader, the lack of a concrete affirmative agenda, and the diffuseness of online activism. All those factors likely played a role, but what's often missed, and arguably more important, is the fact that Occupy attracted so few members from the many disadvantaged groups it purported to be fighting for. Imagine if the suffragette movement hadn't included large numbers of women, or if the civil rights movement included very few African Americans, or if the gay rights movement included very few gays. Internal coherence gave all these movements an authentic and potent group identity that helped them persevere in the face of setbacks to eventually achieve significant results. By contrast, the participants of Occupy were not the hungry or exploited, but rather relatively privileged, self-identified activists. Which is why, when the next big thing to protest came along, Occupy's participants moved on. Sometimes they didn't even have to move on physically, just virtually. As White put it in June 2015, social media has a negative side. People started to feel more comfortable posting on Twitter and Facebook than going to an Occupy event. This is not to say that Occupy wasn't a real movement, with a real group identity capable of mobilizing and galvanizing its members. Many young and relatively privileged Americans today are disillusioned with and frustrated by the world they are entering. As Michael Ellick put it, you have generations of people graduating from high school and college who are in debt for careers that don't exist anymore. We're educated into a world that doesn't exist anymore. Occupy offered a meaningful tribe to such people. It gave members a sense of belonging and status. Protesters from Zuccotti Park to Oakland felt themselves part of a larger movement taking on a big, bad enemy. Its motto was, "We kick the ass of the ruling class." But Occupy gave this sense of belonging and status almost exclusively to the well-educated and relatively privileged. It's not just that the poor didn't participate in Occupy. More often than not, they affirmatively dislike activist movements. More irony still. In the words of a writer from Working Class America, many lower-class Americans view protesters as disreputable and unhelpful, as professional activists who are entirely disconnected from the working class because they've never experienced struggle in their own personal lives, and who protest mainly to find personal validation. In a related context, Nigerian-American novelist Teju Cole once tweeted, "The white savior industrial complex is not about justice. It is about having a big emotional experience that validates privilege." In contrast to the extremely politically active Occupy participants, America's poor are far less politically engaged. They are starkly less likely to work on political campaigns, contact elected officials, or vote. In part, this is because historically marginalized communities tend to distrust strangers and large organizations they see as controlling the levers of power from afar. It's hard to get excited about politics and elections when no matter which party comes into power, your life never changes. In addition, low-income Americans seem to be withdrawing from traditional communal and civic activities. In his 2015 bestseller, Our Kids, Robert Putnam shows that the poor in America are less likely to join athletic leagues, youth groups, and volunteer organizations, leaving them with far fewer social connections and networks. Consistent with Charles Murray's observations in Coming Apart, Putnam also finds that church attendance among the poor and working class is declining, most strikingly among the young. On the basis of this evidence, Putnam concludes that among America's have-nots, we have witnessed a giant swing toward the individualist. But this is not the right conclusion. America's underclasses are intensely tribal. To begin with, many among America's lower classes are deeply patriotic, even if they feel they're losing their country to distant elites who know nothing about them. The ranks of America's police and armed forces, two organizations famous for group loyalty, are filled predominantly with non-elites. Beyond this is a whole world of other group affiliations. It's just that the groups that America's have-nots belong to are often ones that elites view as antisocial, irrational, or even contemptible, if they even know about them at all. Sovereign citizens. In 2014, a survey was taken of hundreds of officials from law enforcement agencies around the country. Whom did these officials identify as the single greatest threat to their communities? Not Islamic extremists or violent street gangs, but a bizarre anti-government group known as the Sovereign Citizens. Although the movement dates back to the 1980s, its numbers began to increase dramatically after the 2008 recession, and experts attribute the movement's rapid growth to high unemployment and economic dislocation. Gavin Long, who shot 6 policemen in Baton Rouge in 2016, 3 fatally, was a sovereign citizen, evidently one of many African-American members unaware of the movement's white supremacist origins. With an estimated 300,000 followers, the movement is based on an elaborate conspiracy theory. Some of its central beliefs include, 1. At some point in American history, the legal system set up by our founding fathers was secretly replaced by an illegitimate government. We know this to be true because of the gold fringe that adorns flags in courtrooms. 2. The illegitimate government currently in power induces Americans to enter into contracts, which turn them into federal slaves. These contracts can be formed, for example, by applying for a Social Security number. 3. The U.S. government uses every newborn's birth certificate to establish a secret corporate trust in the baby's name, which is then used to siphon off future earnings into a secret bank account. Fortunately, sovereign citizens can access the secret bank account through a series of highly complicated legal maneuvers. 4. The creation of the newborn's corporate trust establishes two entities, a corporate shell person, and the natural person. We know this because most government documents, like driver's licenses and tax bills, use all capital letters to spell names. 5. It is possible to avoid being tricked by the illegitimate government by clearly identifying oneself as a natural person as opposed to the corporate shell. This might be done, for example, by specifying, "I am Spencer Todd, representative of," all capital letters, "Spencer Todd, copyright." 6. Through correct formatting of legal documents, sovereign citizens can separate the natural, free, person from the corporate, enslaved, legal entity, liberating themselves from government jurisdiction. Thus, a sovereign could avoid paying tax bills or cable TV bills addressed to, all capital letters, John Smith, by claiming that, all capital letters, John Smith, is a separate legal entity. 7. The only governmental authority that is actually legitimate in America today is the county sheriff. Sovereign citizens specialize in paper terrorism. Sovereigns involved in even minor disputes, for instance contesting dog licensing fees, deliberately inundate courts with filings. Sovereign filings in tax cases often exceed 1,000 pages, overwhelming prosecutors, public defenders, and judges not only with the volume of filings, but with the nonsensical language the documents are written in. Richard Posner, one of the most distinguished judges in the country, newly retired, presided in 2015 over the criminal trial of a sovereign citizen. After a deluge of motions, Judge Posner summarized the defendant's arguments. He also asserts lack of jurisdiction over the person, contracted artificial subject versus natural born, whatever that means. He also asserts that Queen of England entered into a treaty with the federal government for the taxing of alcoholic beverages and cigarettes sold in America. The treaty is called the Stamp Act, and in this act, the Queen ordained that her subject, the American people, are exonerated of all other federal taxes. So the federal income tax and the state income taxes levied against all Americans is contrary to an international treaty and against the sovereign orders of the Queen. Judge Posner responded as follows. The Stamp Act was enacted by the Parliament of Great Britain in 1765. It did not relieve Americans of any taxes. On the contrary, it imposed a comprehensive tax on the use of paper by Americans. The act was not a treaty between Britain and the federal government of the United States, for there was no United States. There were just the 13 British colonies that 11 years later declared independence from Great Britain. There were no federal taxes that the act could have relieved Americans from having to pay. The sovereign of Britain at the time was a king, not a queen. The king's wife, Princess Charlotte of Mecklenburg-Strelitz, was Great Britain's queen, but had no governmental authority. As absurd as sovereign citizens' beliefs sound, the psychological appeal of the movement is easy to understand. Far from being nobodies, sovereigns see what's really going on. Like America's founding fathers, to whom they compare themselves, they are revolutionaries waging war against a tyrannical government. They flock to exclusive seminars and conferences where they bond and strategize with like-minded visionaries. The Washita Nation, an African-American subgroup of the movement, claims a particularly noble provenance. According to one of its recent leaders, who calls herself Empress Verdesi Tiari Washita Turner Gostin L. Bay, members of the Washita Nation fall outside federal authority because they are the descendants of the Ancient Ones, blacks who occupied North America tens of thousands of years before the Europeans arrived. To top it all off, sovereign citizens offer their members the alluring possibility of hitting pay dirt, of eventually, through legal maneuvers yet to be honed, tapping into the giant secret bank account. As the Southern Poverty Law Center put it, sovereigns believe that if they can find just the right combination of words, punctuation, paper, ink color, and timing, they can have anything they want. Freedom from taxes, unlimited wealth, and life without licenses, fees, or laws. Conspiracy theories are strangely common all over the world, but there's something distinctly American about sovereign citizens, and the group's existence tells us a lot about America's class divide. Its members are among America's most disadvantaged, unemployed, in debt, with little or no opportunity to rise, just the kind of people Occupy was trying to help. But sovereigns are not against inequality. They are not opposed to wealth. On the contrary, they want to get it for themselves. Moreover, they are deeply suspicious of the establishment. They believe the entire government is involved in a labyrinthine scheme to keep them down, to deny them the American dream. Street gangs and narco saints. It's a searing indictment of America that so many enterprising urban youth end up joining the Crips, Bloods, Sureños, Asian Boys, or another of America's 27,000 street gangs, often engaged in drug trafficking or other criminal activity. Few groups are more tribal than gangs, which in the United States frequently have a racial or ethnic identity, whether African American, Haitian, Cambodian, Dominican, Somali, Vietnamese, or Salvadoran, like the famously violent Mara Salvatrucha, better known as MS-13. As reflected in gang names like All About Cash, Cash Av, and Cash Money Boys, gang members are often fixated on acquiring money any way they can in order to afford flashy cars and the latest fashions. Many are also ambitious, willing to hustle, take risks, and sacrifice for a chance to rise in the hierarchy. In a sense, street gangs offer doomed versions of the American dream. Most active gang members end up in prison or dead by the age of 20. But for all too many disaffected, unemployed, often minority young men, with few skills and a contempt for low-wage jobs, street gangs offer exactly what the legitimate system doesn't. Status, a strong tribe, and their best, perhaps only, shot at real upward mobility. Also connected to drug trafficking is a very different group popular among America's poor, especially those of Hispanic descent, the cult of Nuestra Señora de la Santa Muerte, Our Lady of the Holy Death. If you walk around San Francisco's Mission District, or Melrose Avenue in central Los Angeles, or Mid-City in New Orleans, you'll see cheap storefronts with female skeletons in the windows, life-size skeletons clad in long black, white, or red robes and usually holding scythes. These are worship houses, or in-store altars for followers of a faith that started in Mexico but has now spread into every American city with a significant Hispanic population. Santa Muerte is, in religious studies professor Andrew Chestnut's words, the fastest-growing religious movement in the entire Americas. A syncretic blend of Catholic and Mesoamerican traditions, Santa Muerte is Mexico's saint of delinquents and outcasts, as Vice put it, fantastically popular among petty thieves, prostitutes, gang members, smugglers, and drug dealers, who tattoo her image on their necks, arms, and backs. Because she doesn't share the Catholic Church's opposition to homosexuality, Santa Muerte is also the patron saint of many members of the LGBT community, including transgender sex workers. She's the saint who doesn't discriminate, so she accepts all comers, says Chestnut. Although most of her devotees are not drug traffickers, she is known as a narco saint who assists smugglers and is far more understanding than the Virgin Mary. As Chestnut explains,